Thank you very much, everyone, for coming to the library tonight. It's so nice to see you here. We have a special night in store for us with Susan Messer. She is from Oak Park, Illinois. Her work, her fiction and nonfiction, has been published in Glimmer Train Stories, North American Review, and the Colorado Review. She has won the Illinois Arts Council Fellowship in Prose, also the Illinois Council Literary Award for Creative Nonfiction, and she has won a prize in the Jewish Cultural Writing Competition from the Center for Jewish Culture. And I read about her because her novel was chosen this past summer for incoming students in the honors program to read the summer before they came in for classes in the fall. So I would like you all to join me in welcoming Miss Susan Messer.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you to Cecile for inviting me. I just have to start by saying I lived in Ann Arbor for many years, and but I've been away for 25 years. But when I come back to Ann Arbor, it's like every street corner is like resonating with memories. It's like wah wah wah. Everywhere I go, it's just such a wash of feelings when I'm here, so I just needed to say that because that's how I'm sort of in this otherworldly state. So let me just last March I was in Ann Arbor and gave a reading at the University of Michigan, with another novelist, and the topic was setting. In literature, establishing setting in literature. And the person who organized the event asked us to each to write a short piece for their blog. And so I just want to read to you what I wrote about setting. A few years back, around 5:30 a.m., I heard an NPR report about Roanoke, William Faulkner's home in Mississippi. What I thought I heard was a quote from Faulkner along the lines of, "I wanted to portray my Mississippi world in a way that made it feel like the center of the universe." Granted, 5:30 a.m. is 5:30 a.m., so I am not surprised to learn that I didn't get this quite right. In fact, as I discovered, it wasn't Faulkner who expressed this idea. It was Richard Haworth, Oxford, Mississippi's mayor and bookstore owner, and what he said in the NPR interview was, "Good writers know that no place is really the center of the universe, and every place can be made to seem so." At the time I was working on my novel about Detroit, a place with a dramatic and troubling story, a place that within a handful of decades went from arsenal of democracy and automobile capital of the world to America's first third world city, a soulful place where much was grand and much was lost. In my fuzzy morning mind, on hearing the NPR story, I thought, I want to do what Faulkner did, make Detroit the center of the universe. So I've had people at readings say to me, well, when writing about Detroit, don't you think you're sort of limiting yourself? And I think that is such a weird question because, you know, every story has to take place somewhere. And, you know, you think about Alice Munro and the tiny towns in Ontario, or, you know, Philip Roth in Newark. That's certainly not a glamorous place. But I think, maybe it's people who live, you know, who have lived in Michigan or Detroit who somehow feel that might not be worthy, a place not worthy of literature, but certainly it is, just as any place is. So I just want to say that about Detroit as a subject of literature. And I think if you've read my book, you know that my book starts on Halloween. And I'm just going to read the first opening about Halloween and then talk a little bit about Halloween and why Halloween. And so he was working with his sister at the time, so it was just the two of them, and he stopped to pick her up on the way down, which was how he described the trip, I'm heading down, he would say to her when he called before leaving the house. Are you ready? All he meant by down, or all he thought he meant, was that the route to the business took him more toward downtown than not. He drove his silvery blue Dodge Dart, a new model, 1966, through the streets of his neighborhood over to hers, the autumn elms and oaks and sugar maples arching over the streets, stopping in front of her house, her waiting on the porch when the weather was fine, as it was that day. A perfect golden day for Halloween, something you couldn't rely on in the Midwest. They said their hellos, Harry and Ilo, not much new since yesterday. He'd come to feel that this was his life, and this was how it would be, from today until tomorrow, and on, not a bad life. With his wife, his daughters, your basic comforts, summer vacations at the Michigan lakes, the great and the small. Then he and Ilo were nearing the end of their well-worn route down, making the turn onto Grand River, crossing Joy Road. It was Detroit, and by 1966, Grand River south of Joy was all concrete and brick, with barely a tree or shrub, barely a patch of grass. Joy Road, now there was a misnomer. That stretch had broken windows and traffic snarls and grown men with nothing to do during the day. Up and down these broad streets, buses belched clouds of black smoke as they roared past the metal-grated building faces, and as if inviting trouble, Levine's was the only business along the stretch that lacked one of those grates. Whenever Harry talked about the place, his sisters-in-laws and cousins with their stiff beauty parlor bouffants and manicures held their faces and said, Schwarze this and Schwarze that. Same for the big-bellied brothers-in-law with their ruby pinky rings and slicked back hair. On Grand River, the ungraded Levine wholesale shoes stood beside the tiny White Castle hamburger building with its crude crenellated top. Across the street and down a few blocks was the magnificent decaying Riviera Theater, or the Iviera, as his sister called it. The R in the towering vertical marquee had become a jagged hole. Farther down, the upper bar of the E appeared gangrenous, and the final R and A were also festering. In the alley behind the business, two small boys scuffed along, kicking the alley stones as they went on their way to school. Ilo checked the door locks. The boys switched to single file so Harry's car could pass. No costumes, Harry said. Halloween's for people who've got something to give away. She shifted her purse from lap to floor. Harry pulled into the parking space under the wooden fire escape that led to the upstairs apartment. Curtis, Harry's tenant, stood on the landing. Harry waved to him as he got out of the car. It was a warm day, with a technicolor blue sky, promising a smooth road straight through to evening, a gift for the children, who could run through the leaves without blustery cold wind or driving rain, without arguments about sweaters that would bulk out costumes or stupid coats that would obscure them entirely. Morning, Mr. Levine, Curtis said. Any work today? So, Halloween. By starting on Halloween, I sort of set up a frame for the book as a book about identities, about, because on Halloween we say, what are you going to be on Halloween? And you can be anything you want on Halloween. But, of course, we sort of know that there are limits to what we can be. And some of those limits are already suggested by this neighborhood where Harry's business is, the decay. There's the boys in the alley who don't have costumes, that, you know, not everybody has the same access to being whatever they want or to whatever identity they choose. Well, none of us really do. I mean, we do to an extent, but we all have constraints based on who we are, where we live, where we're born, our gender, our race, ethnicity, religion. So these are some of the issues that play out, resonate throughout my book. Harry Levine, the main character, has certain dreams and aspirations that he's put aside for various reasons, a sense of duty to his father to go into the business, a lack of confidence that he has the aptitude to perhaps be more than what he is. His wife, Ruth, a woman in the growing up in the 30s, 40s, has certain limitations, but she has aspirations too. She's an intellectual. She's learned. She, at one point, confesses that she might have dreamed of being a rabbi, but in her time, it would have been impossible. A woman in that era didn't even have a bat mitzvah. So you kind of see how that impacts her, the limitations of her life. She's always annoyed. Everything annoys her. There's a certain level of frustration, a sort of boiling over about her. And the third person who we sort of know something about their aspirations is Alvin, the teenage boy who lives upstairs from Harry's business. We sort of intuitively know what the limitations of his life are. African-American teenage boy with not a lot of financial resources. But he's aware of the sort of political rumblings that are going on around him, the black power ideas. He's interested in that. He has musical aspirations. The music culture of Detroit resonates for him. He has the satin jacket that he wears that says chic on the back. He has an idea of himself as a leader, a wise man. So we see that, starting on Halloween kind of can act as a frame for some of those issues of identity and aspirations, what you want to be. And then another thing about Halloween is that... from an anthropological point of view, it's a time where norms are overturned. Children go out at night. They go door to door. They go to strangers' homes. They make demands. So in this book, certain norms of ways of life, what we're used to, how are also overturned or questioned. And then a final thing about Halloween is anybody from Detroit knows that in this era, this when the book takes place, the night before Halloween was Devil's Night, but it was a night of innocent mischief, ringing doorbells, soaping windows. But not too many years later, it became something much more dangerous and with arson, and it became a time of fear and dread. And so the thing is that the people in this book are living in an innocent time. But as with any innocent time, we don't know when we're in it because we don't know what's going to happen next. So there's this so the idea of Halloween in this book has a special resonance for people who know about that later history of Devil's Night. So that, having said that about Halloween, I also will now confess that when I wrote the book, I had no idea about any of that. That's all. I just made all of that up since I wrote the book. It's like with anybody who does any art form of art, you sort of know how much magic there is about it, that the unconscious, in a way, is so much more brilliant than the conscious mind. And so these things, these connections are being made that you don't even know what you're doing until later when you're, standing up in front of a group and this really makes a lot of sense. So anyway, I'm just being honest. So let's see, I'd like to read a couple other sections. I'm going to read a little bit about Ruth. She, early in the book, this is also on Halloween, the same day that, you know, the book opens, she's been invited to make a presentation to the Detroit Council of Jewish Women, which was an organization I thought I was making up, but turns out, like, really exists. So, anyway, so she, it's the 60s, and women want to have a say in what their families do. In the past, you know, the way it worked in Detroit and in cities all over this country, the Jewish community would settle in one area, and for some reason, the Black community would have a more an easier time settling around the Jewish community. But once the, you know, the Black community started getting to be too much, then the Jewish community would move, and then, you know, it would just keep happening. And they, in Detroit, it just kept going north and west. So the Ruth and Harry's generation have already been through several of these moves. And the women feel that, you know, we can make a recommendation about whether we want to stay or whether we want to go. It's not inevitable. It doesn't have to happen that way. And so they've asked her to lead a meeting, and they're going to discuss this, and then they're going to make a recommendation to the men in the community, the community leaders. So she's going to this meeting. She's very nervous. She's tried on multiple outfits, which, you know, is also, you know, has this, like, little Halloween resonance about how we dress up and how we present ourselves to the world and how people judge us because of how we've presented ourselves or what we are because of how we appear. So here she is. She's on her way to the meeting. The subject of her meeting was white flight, which always made her think of a flock of birds, wings beating against each other in beautiful, frantic, and chaotic patterns as each white creature attempted to clear a space for itself among the many others, all rising at the same time or trying to. In the past, men had made the decisions about when to take flight, but this was the 60s, and the Detroit Council of Jewish Women wanted a voice. The topic was changing neighborhoods, a subject even the closest friends tiptoed around. She could be as sociological as she wanted, but the truth was that what everyone wanted to know was when you were moving and how they could find out without revealing their own plan. She and Harry had no special plans to move, though they had made the Sunday drives to the northern suburbs. Probably everyone had, to see the homes and subdivisions and roads as they emerged from the wooded lots. She thought about starting the meeting by asking straight out. She'd go around the circle and have people say what they were thinking, what they were planning. Harry looked at her like she was nuts when she had mentioned that idea two nights ago. They were in their bedroom. She stood in front of her dresser mirror, dabbing night cream on her face and throat. "You can't ask people questions like that," he said. "What if someone asked you?" "I'd tell them the truth. We're talking about it. We drove around, but we never got out of the car." "Yeah," he said. "What about at Green Trees in Southfield? We got out of the car there." "No one has to know about that," she said. And before long, he was snoring while she was pacing. So that's you know, what I think the kind of thing that might have been going on in many homes. And as I often realize, so many times since I've wrote this book and presented it to people, that when you're young, you don't really know very much about what's, or at least I didn't, I won't judge. I didn't know very much about what was going on around me, what my parents, what conflicts they might have been facing along these lines, what they might have been thinking, what the pressures might have been. And at one reading I did, there was a woman there who said, you know, it's one thing to take a stand for, you know, a political stand for yourself as an adult. You know, if you want to, you say, "I'm going to stay. This is when." But if you have children in the school and you're hearing rumors about their safety or that the, you know, the quality of their education is maybe compromised, you're in a different situation. So it's one thing as an adult to make that decision for yourself, another to impose it on your children. So these are, I mean, I think it's a, like a really important issue for the women to be thinking about, because and I think the conflicts were I think there were probably many conflicts, and unfortunately, as a young person, I wasn't aware of them in my home, what my parents were thinking or doing about all that. But so it was shocking, really, when I did a lot of the archival research for this book and discovered some of the things that had been going on in my own neighborhood. That there was that one, I mean, this was a thing that really happened, in the book it's portrayed as like Ruth and Harry have just moved into their new home, and this person comes to the door with a petition. They're trying to change the borders of the school district so there won't be so many black kids in the school district. And so, you know, I was just trying to imagine, what if I just moved into a neighborhood and somebody came to my door and asked me to, you know, take a stand on an issue like that? And what are they going to think if I don't? And what are they going to think if I do? And is this like a friendly place to be, but like we just moved in? And so people were facing things like that. And I'm just grateful that I haven't had to. So now I'm going to read another section. This is proven to be, oh dear, a very, oh yes, here. And a highly controversial scene in the book, in discussions I've been to. The setup for this is that there's been an incident in Harry's neighborhood where a neighborhood boy had his bike stolen from him. Harry has a hobby of buying old bicycles, fixing them up, and he's got like a bunch of them stored, jammed in his basement and under the stairs and every place. And he decided that he is now going to load them all in a truck and take them to this all-black, poor, or, you know, public housing neighborhood and just give them away. Because he sort of has this idea that, I guess this is his thinking, that somehow it'll equalize things. Well, he calls it insurance. You know, like if you give some, you've got more than you need, and there's somebody who doesn't have anything, and if you equalize it, then maybe it's going to, like, help. So he's pulled in. He takes his daughter with him, and he pulls into the place where the public housing place is. One man came up to the driver's side window. He threw his cigarette into the gravel as he did. He was thin and brown with a scraggly beard, wiry little black hairs that grew on his chin and cheeks in patches, like the thin patches of grass that dotted the empty fields around the shoebox houses. His brown wool jacket, stained and fraying, hung on him a few sizes too big, like he was in the process of shrinking while everything around him, the jacket as one indicator, stayed the same. Harry rolled down the window. "You moving furniture?" the man asked. The cold morning air came in with the man's voice. Harry turned down the rattling fan on the heater. "I can do just about anything." Joanna withdrew into her corner of the cab, pressed against the door. She stared ahead at the little houses, wondering how many people could fit in one. When she'd agreed to come, she'd pictured children and bicycles and joy. This was something different. "I'm sorry, Harry," he said. "I'm not looking for workers right now." As if not looking for workers was a temporary situation. He might change his mind any minute. Something might can't come up as he sat there in the truck. Another man came up to the truck. "What's he looking for?" the new man asked. He wore a red scarf tied like an ascot. He didn't look at Harry, but at his fellow day laborer, as if he were the translator, as if there were no point speaking directly to the foreigner. "He ain't said yet," the first man said. He hadn't said, because this was not an easy question to answer. The thing was that he wasn't really looking for anything he could say in a way that would make sense to these men, who were looking for something far more tangible and important than what Harry was looking for. At least that's how it seemed to him at the moment. And he couldn't simply say, "I'm looking for children," because that would probably make him sound suspicious. And he couldn't say insurance, which was how he'd explained this outing to his family, because these men would know this was not a place that a man like him came looking for insurance. and certainly not in a big old truck with rattling cargo that said Formica City, and he certainly couldn't explain to them what he meant by insurance, because that would be an insult, like saying, I'm here to bribe you so you won't rob me. I've got a truckload of bikes, Harry said, he indicated with his thumb, to give to the children. Two more men had come up by now. What did he say? One asked. Something about bikes, said another, for the children. Bikes, said the first one, adjusting his cap. Bikes. He paused. What are you, Santa Claus or something? The other man laughed. You sure don't look like Santa Claus. Which made Harry wonder whether this meant that the man knew he was Jewish, whether they could guess, whether it showed on his face. Nope, Harry said, not Santa Claus. Just have a lot of bikes and want to give them away where someone might be able to use them. You brought your assistant with you, the man with the red scarf said, an elf or something? She's my daughter, Harry said. Seven or eight men had gathered around the truck by now, all on Harry's side. Well, come on then, the man said with the red scarf. Show us what you brought. Harry hesitated. He had envisioned himself surrounded by children, not grown men. But these men didn't seem threatening. Harry was a man, too. They were standing near 8 Mile, with lots of traffic passing. And if they stole all his bikes? Well, he had come to give them away, so what would be the difference? He turned off the engine and got out. You really got a truck full of bikes? The man in the brown jacket asked. Yes, I do, Harry said. He walked around to the back of the truck. He opened the padlock and slid the door up. What a racket it made, groaning and clanking up its tracks. He stood aside and the men looked. He's got bikes, a man with a black cap said. He sure does, said the one with the red scarf. By then a few women and children, a few teenaged girls had gathered. Harry left the back open and went to get Joanna. Come on, he said, it's okay. She sat plastered against the door. She didn't want to get out. She wanted to go home. Come on, he said again. She shook her head no. But then she saw a little boy standing near Harry and watching her. Maybe he was 7 or 8, dark and wiry. He wore a striped T-shirt and his hair was closely shorn, looking like a tight, fuzzy cap. He was eating a piece of toast, and she remembered the notebooks she used to keep with the rows and columns and check marks, her bike inventory. What was the point in keeping track, in accumulating, and having an inventory if it hung on hooks, jammed in and increasingly tangled in a basement? Bikes were for riding, and here was a little customer. She opened her door, slid down from the truck, and walked around the back, staying close to Harry, keeping her eyes to herself, embarrassed that someone might recognize her from school or that she might recognize them. Harry pulled a wooden step stool from the truck, unfolded it, and motioned for Joanna to climb up. He followed her, and together they untangled a small huffy, one that seemed like it would fit the small boy in the striped shirt, pulling and lifting it out from the rest, moving others out of the way, pedals getting caught in spokes of neighboring bikes, handlebars hitching onto each other. He wheeled it forward. He held it out over the side of the truck, the small bicycle hanging in the air in his hands. Here, son, would you like this one? The boy nodded, staring at the bike, finishing the last bite of toast, wiping his fingers on his pants. Go ahead, Harry said, it's yours. Other people came closer to see what it was about, to see if the boy would take it, to see if this was a joke or a trick that the white man was playing, that he would grab it back once the boy reached out, that he would laugh or insult, call the boy greedy, that he would call the police later in the day, maybe, to give the description of the striped shirt, the shaved head, a boy perhaps 7 or 8. The man with the red scarf was there, as was the man in the brown jacket. They watched. It's real, Joanna said. Come on, take it. Look how many we have. The boy looked. Are you going to take it? Harry asked. He got down from the truck and put the bike on the ground in front of the boy. The boy stooped to look at it. He spun the rear tire. It's yours, Harry said. Do you know how to ride? The boy nodded while tracing his finger over the handlebars to the blue and white plastic streamers that hung from them. He held the streamers in his hand as if he were weighing them. Well, good, Harry said. So that's the beginning of the bicycle giveaway, and if you've read the book, it, you know, sort of escalates from there into something somewhat unexpected for Harry. And And I think, you know, it's a, you know, this issue about giving, you know, how does one give? If you have something and you know of people who have less, how do you give to them? And some people are more comfortable doing it through institutional channels or a more anonymous way. But he had this idea of just being very direct about it. And I'll be interested to hear what people have to say about it. That's been upsetting to a number of readers, but it's always been an interesting conversation. And I'm just going to read one more short section. And then I'd be interested in hearing a discussion and questions and so forth. So this scene comes late-ish in the book, and it's a flashback. Harry is working for his father. He's a young man. He's just graduated from high school. He's been working for his father, you know, forever. That's sort of what he sees as in his future. And just one day, he's just had it, you know, with being obedient. And so he just walks out, and he just walks out the back door and of the business. And he has an adventure. He meets a man who takes him on a walk, and and they end up at the Detroit Institute of Arts. This is in the 1930s. They walked through the heavy doors, and compared with the bright light of this fall day, the large room they entered was dark, and Harry stalled as his eyes adjusted. Harry's companion waved to a woman at the desk near the door, and she waved back. They passed into another room, high-ceilinged, one of the highest ceilings Harry had ever seen. It was an enclosed courtyard with a rectangular pool in the middle. Scaffolds lined the walls all the way to the ceiling, with walkways at various levels. Sitting on a bench in one corner with a paintbrush was a fat man in overalls, black curly hair and bulging eyes like frog eyes. Others worked around the man, carrying things, moving things, looking at large sheets of paper hanging on the walls or lying on the floor. Up on the scaffold was a woman, pacing. Her heels drummed on the wooden platform. She looked like someone out of a fairy tale or a Bible story, thin with black hair pulled back, tight, and braids wrapped around her head like a crown. She wore a long white dress. He could see the dress through the scaffold, a bright shawl wrapped around her shoulders, the full white skirt flowing as she paced, and all her attention was focused on the man with the paintbrush. That man's named Diego Rivera, Root said, and as if on cue, the fat man looked up at Root, and he nodded at him. He's from Mexico, and Edsel Ford brought him here to paint this whole room. Parts of the wall were already filled with images, though some were only sketches, outlines that looked like machine parts, and huge hands reaching and grasping. The men on the walls lifted car parts, soldering, drilling, all crowded in together like a dance. Root said he worked here, preparing the walls for Mr. Diego with all the layers, sand, mixed with plaster, smoothed in the final coat to a surface like marble, and that Mr. Diego was very particular about how it was done. If the wall was too wet when he was ready to work, the colors couldn't hold, and if it was too dry, forget it, Root said. Diego had to paint in sections so the wall would be just right. And he can only do the colors in daylight, Root said, so he sketches at night, starting around midnight. The lady, he said, looking up at her, and Harry followed his gaze, she just watched. Sometimes she came over and stood close to Diego as he worked, and sometimes Mr. Diego stopped for a moment, went to her, and hugged her. All the men talked about it, the way she dressed, the way she watched, the way the two spoke to each other in their language, like some kind of music with syncopation. Root pointed way up to the top of the room, the sections with the women of the four races, like parts of the earth. He liked those, he said, though he wasn't sure what people were going to think about them being naked. Mr. Diego was particular about that, too, about making it natural. In one small section, he'd painted a fetus in the womb. But look, Root said, how he made the womb like part of the earth, showing how the earth contains all life and how a woman was like the earth. It all blends together. It makes sense if you let yourself see it. It wasn't only a celebration, this painting. The faces of some of the workers were going to be green, Root said, as if they were being poisoned, and he pointed to the sketches of the weapons, another product of these factories. He pointed out the weary looks on the faces of the workers in the small panels along the bottom, carrying in their lunch pails at the beginning of the day, and even wearier when they were leaving at night. He described what it was supposed to do, giving you the feeling of being enveloped and surrounded by huge banging machines, squeezed in with all these other men and having only one small job to do over and over again. Mr. Diego keeps working. He doesn't answer to anyone, he says. The pictures come from inside him, he says, like the baby from the earth. Once it's formed, it's got to come out. That's what he says. Most people Harry knew worked in family businesses, scrap metal, auto parts, or they had learned the trades, plumbing, construction. A few from Europe had skills like tailoring or shoe repair. Some young men his age planned to become doctors or lawyers. But who knew there were options like these, like what Mr. Diego did, or even Root? Who knew that an auto plant could be the subject for art? It's really something, Harry said. He kept saying that as if being something was the ultimate. So that's Harry discovering. I just think that the frescoes, which I'm sure most of you have seen at some point, and if you haven't, you should take a field trip. I must have seen them hundreds of times growing up. I never really understood them, where they'd come from, what they meant, why the faces were green. Why the women were naked, what that baby was. I mean, it wasn't until I went back when I was writing the book and really sat and, meditated on that room and listened to the docents going through, bringing school children through and explaining to them. And it's just such a perfect metaphor for Detroit, the melding of art and commerce. So I said that was all I was going to read, but there is one more thing I want to read, because of what you said to me, this gentleman back there, about, people often, think about, when they think about Detroit, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? What's happening in Detroit? Is it, is it ever going to recover? Is it, I think I really feel that depends on where you look, where you happen to be gazing at the moment, that there's, it's, so this is on the last page of the book, and I guess this is what I really think, and this is what Harry thinks, and I guess we think alike, so. Everywhere he looked, he saw various stages of repair and decay. The world was served up as a spectrum from marvelous to ravaged, with an infinite number of way stops and combinations. People's bodies, a building, roads, a house, cars, given car parts, mufflers, radiators, tires, items in his own refrigerator, a piece of apple pie left too long, a hunk of cheese, tree stumps, relationships. You couldn't say that anything was just one way, decaying or rebuilding on the upswing or the down, dying or surviving. It all depended on the moment and on where you looked. It was a matter of proportion. He'd see a detail on the crown of a building, marvelous, left over from its glory days in the 20s, while at street level a sloppy hand-painted sign or heavy metal grate, even barbed wire, covered its face. Or something could look beautiful on the outside, a woman, a tree, and inside there was sickness, something growing that was also destroying. This was what he had come to understand about the world. So, thank you for listening. And I'd love to hear any comments or questions, with or without microphones. Yeah. Anybody? Yes. There's one up here. Oh. Okay. Yeah. We went to high school together. We graduated from high school together.
High school with Susan. I just wanted to have Curtis and
Alvin.
And Harry. Remind me of some of Philip Levine's characters. Have you ever talked to him about that, or
I would love to talk to him. Philip Levine, I'd love to talk to him. I tried to get him to do a blurb for my book, but he said he doesn't do that because it offends too many people. Is he a friend of yours?
No, I've been to a couple readings.
Oh, I love his his poetry is beautiful. Oh, absolutely. I would have loved to have him. And his father's name was Harry Levine. He did say that. He said, oh, that's my father's name. I'll read the book. But he wouldn't give me a blurb.
I know, of course, you grew up in Detroit and so on, but were some of these incidents, do you remember some of these incidents, for example, the Marvin Gaye incident and the one where Harry stays all night with the boiler going up and that sort of thing? Do incidents from your life inform the story?
Well, I would say that my life is sort of maybe you would call it the infrastructure of the book, because I did grow up on Appaline. I lived on Appaline. My father did own a wholesale shoe business at Grand River and Joy. I'm the middle of three sisters. And Marvin Gaye did move into the neighborhood. But whether he had a party and whether he invited everybody in the neighborhood, he didn't invite me if he did that. Those big scenes are imagined, the boiler room, the bicycle giveaway, the trip to the art museum, the night in the hotel, the Moroccan luncheon, those are all imagined. So it has autobiographical elements, of course. Yeah, I went to Mumford. Oh, no questions are ridiculous. Yes?
Grand River and more the west side of Detroit last year.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Oh, well, it does. No, it's much farther, much farther downtown. If you go, if you drove south on Livernois, when you get to Grand River, where Livernois intersects with Grand River, it's right around there. So it's like south of 5 Mile. It's south of... I don't think I have any of my maps with me. If you Google it, it's there. I don't think I have any of my maps, but it's there. It does it. You know where the Riviera Theater and the Grandy Ballroom and the Olympia Stadium, which is like a really interesting stretch of cultural icons, and they're all gone or destroyed or more or less by now, but. I did get to know Russ Gibb a little bit. He was the man who bought the Grandy Ballroom and turned it into like a rock and roll, venue in the 60s. And so I talked to him a little bit about his memories of the neighborhood then. And some of those are, reflected in the book. So, yeah, but it, yes.
I was wondering, do you delve much into the historical antecedents of Motown and the riots and you alluded to the antagonism between different ethnic classes and the Chaldeans coming into Detroit.
Yeah.
And what years does your book encompass? I haven't read it. But
okay. It's a year. It's 1966, Halloween of 1966 to Halloween around there of 1967. Yes, although it skips 20 years and there's sort of an epilogue that's 20 years later. I'll just reveal this little fact to you, which is that in the original conception of the book, there was a scene, a prelude, that took place 20 years before, so in the 40s. The 40s, the 60s, and then the 80s. So it was sort of like a triptych. It was just a short prelude, then the main part of the book, then the... And so it had a little more symmetry, maybe. But my editor didn't like the prelude, so it ended up, and I was so in love with that. But anyway, so it's basically a year, and then it skips 20 years. I just felt like it really represented the arc of the Detroit story, the 40s, the 60s, and the 80s. So you missed the 40s, but there's a couple of flashbacks, so into the 30s. So, hi.
Hi. We read your book.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Cool.
Thank you.
And my whole family lives in Detroit and Metro Detroit. I'm from Ann Arbor, but mm-hmm. I have been to Detroit a lot. My father lives in Harper Woods. I don't know if you...
It's familiar. I don't know exactly.
And my grandma lives in St. Clair Shores, so I've been all over there. And there's always this sense of, like, desert. Like, there's no one there. And with your book, I felt that there's, like, this hope within me, you know, that maybe that... one day it can actually look like that again. And it makes me want to go back and, you know, actually look at the architecture and, you know, go to Eastern Market and things like that, where my mom, you know, grew up in Detroit, so she always wants to take me there, but mm-hmm. I just feel this great pull to Detroit.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful, living, vibrant city that we grew up in. And it's just astonishing, really. It could happen anywhere. It could have happened anywhere, but it happened in Detroit. I often wonder, and people say, why Detroit? And I mean, I think there's the one industry town aspect of it. The being so centered on the auto industry is possibly one factor. But I also can't help feeling that the unresolved racial issues somehow contributed in some manner. I don't exactly know how much, but I'm glad if it gave you a hopeful feeling. Thank you. Thank you for reading it. Yes?
I was thinking too about my parents when they wanted to move to the suburbs. There wasn't
really that much conflict with them. They just wanted to move to the suburbs and have a suburban type house. And I wonder, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of identity in Detroit with a generation. It's almost like each generation has to do something different than the previous generation. There doesn't seem to be any kind of core, and I think a lot of my kids spend all their time in Detroit now doing sort of the same thing, almost looking for something that's been missed.
Really?
Yeah. And I wonder if Detroit's unique in that way, and that people... you go to Chicago, and there's a downtown, and they're into Chicago, and they're into being from Chicago, and you get that in other cities. But Detroit seems to always have this sort of vacant quality about it. People just walk away from stuff. We appreciate the beautiful Art Deco buildings now, but in the 60s, it seemed like, no, we wanted new in Southfield. We wanted...
Yeah. You know what I mean? Oh, I totally know what you mean. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Stuff, like you said,
Yeah.
It just seems I just don't see that in other cities. But
the lack of honoring of the preservationist instinct. You mean,
yeah,
or
perhaps, or even a place like Grosse Pointe, people identify with being in Grosse Pointe, and they maintain the houses, and they're very proud. A lot of them are very proud to be there. But in Detroit, it doesn't seem to be there as strongly.
Mm.
People move away. For years, we've lost, 30,000 young people a year out of not just Detroit, but Michigan. And you just think, why don't people want to stay? Or what?
Well, I always have to, put a little caveat. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a historian. I'm a novelist. I'm more interested in emotional truth than, really what these issues are all about, or how to solve them, or why they even arose. But I do feel that there was a kind of a built-in, you know, the city sort of destroyed itself. And I mean, because it was about cars, so, like, they took away all the public transportation. You know, they had a great street railway system at some one point. They got rid of that. They divided up the, you know, city with highways to get people out, you know, as fast, you know, so people could move through, as, you know, broke up neighborhoods. I mean, all cities did that to some extent. But as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, all cities did that. They put in highways, broke up neighborhoods, built suburbs. But for some reason, Detroit emptied out. People didn't honor what was there. It sometimes seems, I had somebody in a reading once say, well, it seems like such a waste. You know, here you've got a whole city. You've got, you know, hospitals, schools, roads, museums, culture, you know, and they, you know, the people left it all behind and went out to this, you know, sort of denatured, you know, I mean, we were on book tour last, I guess it was spring, and one night we stayed at the Inn on Ferry Street downtown. I mean, that is such a beautiful place. It is so gorgeous. And then the next night, or the night before, whatever it was, we stayed out in, you know, one of the suburbs, and it's just like strip mall after strip mall. I mean, there's no trees. It's like, I mean, they left this. I mean, not they. I don't mean they. We, every, you know, all of us, you know, sort of left this for this. Yes. '67.
Actually, there was just a mass exodus of white people and the taxes, and what was left behind were more the impoverished. And it seems, I agree with what you were saying, that I think Detroit kind of tends to discard, and it seems dispensable what they've built. I've noted that also, just an observation.
I do want to say one thing about that word riots, because you know, you may have noticed in my book that every chapter has a one-word title except for that one chapter, which is riots/rebellion. And the reason for that is because I think that, you know, there are people who see what happened in 1967 as, you know, random thuggery, and people who see it as having a lot of political intentionality and, like, all kinds of stuff in between that. And I... you know, for like marketing purposes, and even when I talk about it, I use the word riots, but I'm not comfortable with that word, as I think it needs to, you know, that we all, for all of us, need to kind of open that up a little bit. And so I didn't want to commit to one or the other. So, and I've had people in reading say, well, we always called it the uprising. So I just, you know, like to hope to expand one, you know, people's thinking about that a little bit. But, you know, just the other thing I want to say in response is that the white flight was well underway by the time of the riots. It was the suburbs. When you read my book, which I'm sure you will, you know, you'll see that a lot of the institutions were already in the suburbs, that there was a lot of sprawl out there already. So, yes.
Yeah, I'm really glad we got to read your book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so
really
much.
Really interesting. I pretty much read it in a night.
Wow, thank you.
Thanks. I feel like one of the most burning questions for me was, how did you create Harry? Like, what were your thought processes going into that, and why was he your main character?
Mm.
He's so interesting and deep.
Oh, thank you. That's such a hard question for, I think, you know, I think if you asked any artist, you know, like, of any, in any art form, to say, like, why, or it's as I said before, so much of it happens on the unconscious level. I will say that I would say that my father is, in some ways, my father did own a shoe business at, you know, so I know something about the shoe business, and I think my father's personality was, you know, he's kind of a gentle, you know, sort of, you know, I mean, you could, I guess, say ordinary, humble, you know, whatever. So he may be at the, you know, heart of Harry Levine. But so much of it happens in a, you know, it's like alchemy or something like that once you get going. I mean, and I wanted him to be more complicated than, you know, just like a good man or, you know, something like that. Like, he gets himself into these messes, you know, the he says things he shouldn't. He, you know, and one thought I started having about Harry after I wrote the book was that, you know, you could say that he's a dutiful man, or you could say that he's a humble man or an ordinary man, but I think that maybe he has, like, this feeling about himself as, you know, like, if he knows the world around him is about to change, that things are pretty shaky. He's trying not to give in to fear about that. And if he just keeps doing what he's doing, like, he just shows up every day, shows up on time every day, you know, dresses well, you know, presents himself well, does his duty, you know, so he almost might have this, like, magical, realistic idea about his capacity to keep things in balance. If there's just one reliable, you know, man left in the world, then maybe it'll hold together. So I don't know whether that makes any sense to you, but yeah. Thanks so much for reading it. Yes?
Just thinking about Harry, I just threw it all in the room. The scene of the bicycles, you know, when he gets in that, he's telling that woman, just let your child have the bicycle.
Yeah.
And then you compared it to when he's arguing with his neighbors. I mean, what was so remarkable, one of the many things remarkable about the book to me, was how just incredibly real Harry was, and all of the things that went on in his head back and forth. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was amazing that you could write that.
You know,
about it. And, because he wanted to be himself, he wanted to be true to himself, and sometimes he was doing that knowing it was really the wrong thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's just so real. I just don't remember anybody actually putting that into words before. Mm. Having poor Harry, you know, do it over and over again. you know, you really just felt for the guy, just fighting for his humanity in a situation that he was in way over his head. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing, like trying to get perspective in a situation that you don't understand, really, you know, with Calvin and just the whole situation, and trying to be who you are and trying to understand it. And the way he always had almost 180 degree
Yeah.
But, you know, historically, we can all look back and say, oh, you know, we wish or... But, you know, when you're in the moment and there's no one around you who has any answers, mm-hmm. and both Harry and Ruth, they're just trying to figure it out, especially Harry just swings one side, especially when you have Calvin there. You know?
Calvin.
Well, I meant...
Curtis.
Oh, Curtis. Sorry, mixed the scene.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you have
Curtis. The boiler, the whole their conversations. Yes. Yeah, that's
and just
right.
Trying to be real with Curtis. Like,
yeah.
Do I ask him about things?
Yeah.
The whole thing is so amazing. And the other thing I really loved was this little bit of is it Joanna, the daughter in the ice with the
mm-hmm.
bicycles?
Mm-hmm.
Her actually raising her head enough to actually look at those homes mm-hmm. and realize they weren't all the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just that little thing, and just your description, just what that meant to that girl, that
you know,
day.
Thank you. Since you mentioned that thing, and nobody has ever mentioned that thing about the houses, and I remember so clearly where that came from, I can tell you that I was working on that scene during the Hurricane Katrina thing, and I was looking at, you know, all the images from the news, and I noticed, and it was a picture of houses, and the houses looked like they were in really bad shape. But I looked at it long enough that I started seeing that they weren't all alike. They each had, you know, some individual expression, and that really mattered to me. And that's why I wrote that. And that's where that, to notice the differences, yeah.
Hi, I'm going to admit, I didn't read the book. And to tell you the truth, I'm a New York transplant. I've lived here for 13 years. But what I found over the years is whenever I'm traveling outside of Michigan, and especially like with my family, and we're coming across other people from New York and New Jersey, the metropolitan area, they, you know, I get kind of defensive when they start making comments about, you know, oh, we should just dump Detroit in the river or sell it to the Canadians or something like that. And I was just kind of, you know, wow. And quite frankly, I'm eager to read the book, not only because it sounded very interesting in the description on the website, but also because every single time, ever since I've lived here, you know, and I grew up in New York mostly, I mean, before that, South Carolina, and I've also lived abroad, and I came from an immigrant family, and my mother works in one of the worst parts of New York City. So you can't tell me that dilapidated areas of cities that are just so run down that they look like third world slums are exclusive of Detroit.
Oh, right, of course.
You know, but the thing is that what I was trying to say was having seen all that, I've also seen a lot of, like, I've always been very curious about Detroit, you know, why are there some areas that are, you know, so run down, what happened? And whenever I would ask people from Detroit or from Michigan, you know, what happened, they were always, you know, they always had kind of a one-sided answer. I never really got a whole story, to be quite honest, which is why I'm actually very eager to read the book. And
I don't know if there is a whole story. I mean, it's
right. But they're very hush-hush. And it was funny. I was, out of the group of people that I became friends with over the years in Ann Arbor, I'm usually the one that's always very keen to go to Detroit. I mean, especially when you go to museums like the African American Museum or the Arab American Museum, which, by the way, is an excellent museum, mm-hmm. you not only get a sense of the history of these two ethnic racial groups, but how much Detroit ties into that, not just because the museums are there, but, you know, especially with the Arab American Museum. The question I wanted to ask was, and I'm sorry I came late, so maybe you had spoken about this before, when you've gone on tour to promote the book and you've gone outside of Michigan, what has been your response? I mean, just because my response about whenever I talk about Detroit, and again, not as an author, but just as, like, you know, somebody who lives in Michigan and actually really likes to go into Detroit, is the response I get is quite hostile. Like, oh, you know, so I'm just curious
to
hear your response.
I haven't had any hostile response at all. Yeah, I haven't had any. I mean, I was at a reading in Pittsburgh, and the And the place, the it was in a sculptor's studio, and I can't remember the neighborhood of Pittsburgh, but afterward somebody came up to me and said, oh, it's so amazing that you're reading here in this place, this space, because this used to be the old Jewish neighborhood of Pittsburgh, and then it, you know, became African American. Now it's being revived again, kind of as an artist's neighborhood. And so, I mean, I think people all over can. I was at a reading, a woman from Washington, D.C., you know, same thing. I mean, it happened all over the country. For some reason, Detroit imploded. For reasons I've suggested some of what I think. There's many other, reasons, and it's a complicated situation, but I haven't. I think people, a lot of people maybe don't even think Detroit exists anymore. They don't understand the importance of the story of Detroit, that it's important to everyone, that it could happen in any city. So I haven't had that kind of hostility. Yes?
I was wondering if you had any feedback from African-American readers, and especially in the Detroit area.
Yeah, I have. I did a reading at... Liz and Jim were at the Frederick Douglass branch of the Detroit Public Library, which is on Grand River, way downtown, at Trumbull, way into the city. And it was a mainly African-American audience that day, and it was wonderful. It was an amazing... My friend Liz Colburn was there. She's a makeup artist, and she did makeup on the woman who is the head of the branch. I mean, it was just so wonderful. They had food. They were so welcoming. They knew just what I was talking about the black and Jewish populations moving around each other. Some of them talked about how hard it is to live in Detroit, I mean, I'm ready to give up on Detroit, one of the women said. You know, my car gets broken into every night. You know, it's hard. But it was a wonderful library. I mean, they brought people in, you know, on buses to hear me, and it was a great conversation. And so I haven't had any hostility or, I mean, I've sometimes felt uncomfortable that perhaps I would offend somebody, if something I said in my book would offend. And any time you're talking about race, you know, you're like, you just never know, but it's so far so good. Last night I was at an event in Huntington Woods. It was very mixed race group, and it was really, really interesting. very warm, and you know, people very interested in talking about these things. So, yes.
I found that the subtlety of sort of different Jewish paths to America and different Jewish families and kind of this resonance of assimilated Jews and those not was really wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You know, straight back to European history, and I just really loved that.
Thank you.
Being a child growing up in Toledo, Ohio, that faced the same kind of issues, and my mother was giving these presentations to the League of Women Voters. I would also compliment you on just this dialogue and these presentations and just the voices of these differing women.
Thank you.
So beautifully done.
Thank you.
But here's my question.
Okay.
The book, which I read in a white heat over the summer, and have since gone back to, really lives very strongly. And even more so, is it going to be possible for you to write another one? How long is it going to take you to kind of let go of this one?
That is a really good question, and it's something I'm struggling with now, because I work full-time also. I'm an editor, and I work full-time as an editor. So writing is, you know, around the margins of the more remunerative work, shall we say. And I do have a second novel, and it's I have 400 pages written, very rough pages, not about Detroit. And it's just a matter of, you know, getting the time to and so promoting this book. I don't want to let this go. People are still interested in it. You know, I'm still a year and a half out. I mean, it came out in July of 2009, and people are still interested in hearing me and. So I don't want to let it go. So promoting that, working full-time, and working on another novel is very challenging. And I also have to say that, you know, now that I see this book has resonated so much with people from Detroit, that there's this little bit of the voice of commerce, you know, whispering in my ear that, you know, like if you have a identified market, that, like, it helps, you know, like, it's not like, you know, I'm not, like, a famous author or something, like, if they see my name and they go out and get my book, so having a, you know, being able to target it, you know, in a, has really helped my book, and, you know, even the University of Michigan choosing it as the, you know, because they want to focus more on Detroit and, you know, have their students thinking in a more regional way, so knowing that having a market handle, I mean, I don't want to have my art be influenced by commerce, but so I don't know the answer. I'm just saying. Just saying. There's that voice. Anybody else? Maybe we should.
I have one question.
Yes.
Is your father's warehouse still there?
No. No, there's hardly anything there anymore.
Somebody saw this, and he's looking at it, and he must have read the article. He says, I know that warehouse.
Oh. No.
This is
fiction. Yeah. Yeah, somebody at my reading last night said, well, was his name really Harry Levine? And I said, who? You know? The man in the book. Right, no, so.
Real quick, can you recommend any other Detroit writers?
Philip Levine. Yeah, he's a poet. Philip Levine is a poet. Well, you know, Jeffrey Eugenides, of course, you know, Middlesex, Joyce Carol Oates wrote about this period in a book called Them. I don't know. There was a movie, 8 Mile. The what? Oh, yeah. At Mary Grove. I did a reading at Mary Grove with two guys. Oh, yeah. Michael Zadurian, he lives in Detroit, and what was his name? Peter. They're really. Oh, I wish I could remember. If you write to me through my website, I'll tell you his name. I just can't think of it right now. I'm sorry, Peter something. He was cool. Yeah.
Well, like I said, I'd like everybody to have a chance to get their book signed by Susan. And I want to thank you very much for coming tonight. Thank you.